Okay, then let's start. We're already running a little late, so I'll try to be kind of a quick talk so we don't run out of time too much. What I'll talk about this morning is the trends in hardware, where we are going, what that means for the software, what we have to do about it as the programmers of that software, with an eye on what that all means for OpenOffice development. As you probably all know by now, the trend that CPUs get faster every year will not continue that way. What we experience now is that instead of getting faster CPUs, we get more processing units per machine. So you have to keep these processing units all busy. Multiple CPUs per machine or hyper-threading technology becoming popular with all the CPU manufacturers. Herb Sutter, known to the C++ community, keeps saying that, yes, we have to do something. We have to make sure our applications actually exploit this concurrency, or else you'll have an application that won't become faster in the future. And as we all know, applications don't become faster with faster hardware, because applications also evolve and take up more cycles. So we would actually run slower in the future if we don't do anything. So where are we with the OpenOffice today? We have an application that is mostly single-threaded. It's just built around the traditional event loop idea. And it has a few additional threads popping up now and then, mostly for things like things that need to be interrupted if they run out of time, like with the file name auto-completion. It is working in the background and supplying new parts of the file name as you type it. But it is not something that exploits parallelism in any way. It's just the technicality to have it in a null thread, but not to spawn across multiple. When you do remote UML, you also have additional threads running, and that actually is a problem as of today. I'll come back to that later. You all know when you have a few hundred pages, write a document, starting that up, freezes the GUI for a moment, and you, for example, you can't start searching that document right away. You have to wait until it is up before you can do anything. And what you would like is, say, start and then open the search dialog, and of course it is the term you want to search is at the end and it hasn't been loaded yet. It will take a while, but you don't want this to have this bad experience you have ever today. The reason for all this is OpenOffice code is quite old by now, or the basics. It was written with a single-threaded vision, with a single-threaded model in mind, and when threading became popular, it just made sure that the code more or less keeps working on multiple threads, and they are threaded global mutex, which has to be locked for extended amount of time whenever you do something with the UI. So parallelism is not there, because you just lock this mutex to make sure that only one thread actually runs at any given point in time. And as I said, code is not or was not prepared to be used multi-threading in a multi-threaded way. So when you have multiple incoming UNO connections, which each have their own thread that actually does something, like modifying a document, when you do that with multiple threads from multiple connections, you fairly easily let Office crash. So when you use Office as a server product, the wisdom of the day is to have a single dedicated Office per server job. And that's, of course, using resources, too much resources. So why all that? Why do we have a picture like that? Well, the reason, of course, is the way you typically program a multi-threaded application when you have a C++ code is using pthreads or Windows threading API. And the paradigm is you have state, the variables, the variables of your object, if you're object-oriented like C++, and they're shared across all threads. So you have to make sure to lock access to your variables so that you do not run into race conditions. And all this is hard stuff. You probably don't get it right. And you do not get it right in an application as huge as an office. And there are many, many traps, and we ran into most of them, I guess. Just a few examples up here. For one, you need those mutexes. We have recursive ones, so if you have a mutex locked and then relock it again in the same thread, that works. But that actually is of no use if you think about it. It only hides actual errors in the code, probably. Because if you know where your invariants are broken, you have to lock those regions exactly. And if you lock too much, each mutex is actually a bottleneck, because only one thread can work at a time. So what you want to do is lock as short as possible, and then you never need recursive mutexes. So this is the big bug. It helped with those global solar mutex, because, as I said, you lock for almost all the time anyway, so there it doesn't matter. But if you move forward, this would be a problem. Another example I just stumbled over last week or before was that we have an abstraction on top of pthreads and a Windows API that has conditions, waiting on conditions. Dead easy things have to work all the time. Didn't work all the time. Worked for a couple of years until a new Solaris version came up that has more often spurious wake-ups than older versions, and oops, some of the time it didn't work. So you have to be careful with designing this stuff, and you can make lots of little mistakes that don't show up for years and then suddenly pop up. Just another example is with notifying other entities in the code that something has changed. We have this in Uno, we have these property change events that one entity sends to another or to broadcast to multiple others to say something changed, like the color of some portion of text changed from green to red. We also transport the old and the new value of what has changed. So you'd say it has changed from red to green. But we can only send these at times where we don't hold locks on this object, so others can come and also change the values again from green to blue, from red to blue, say. And by the time someone gets this notification, they would see, oh, it's red now, but in reality it's already blue. So these values that we transport there, they are of no real means if you start to think about it. So just a design mistake, except by Metal and the bad one. So what can we do? Where can we go? Can we clean this all up and have a fast application then? And I guess, no, we can't do that. It's just too much of code. So in an ideal world, what could we do? But before I come to bed, just have some little rant in between, because the world of computer science is so big, and there are so many great ideas there. But what I experience all the time when talking to colleagues is many of those ideas are not even known. So you don't even have an idea where you want to go, what you could change, like talking to somebody about cloggers, and then they stare at you, cloggers, what? this might change when Java and C Sharp, they are on the track now to also have closures. Even Scott Myers, known to most of you probably from his C++ books, it doesn't help if he admits that he has no real ideas about these terms. So, ran off. What can we do? There are many other languages besides the traditional stateful object-oriented train of C++ to Java to scripting languages like Ruby and Python. There are interesting models out there whose ideas, at least, you could use in your code, because in any language you can program in any model. You just have to know these models, I guess, and then you can make use of these ideas even in traditional languages like C++ or Java. So I have a few slides about two interesting ones I like. One is Auth, the other is Haskell. Auth uses some multi-paradigm language comparable to C++, but stresses the idea of logic variables that are only assigned once and after that can change their value. And Haskell is the most prominent non-strict functional language. And another interesting quote from, a famous quote from Greenspan, that every big application is in fact half of Common Lisp. So if you actually know Common Lisp, you might have a chance to not reinvent the wheel everywhere and get caught in the traps that are there. But again, there is no silver bullet, so you have to make informed choices what you're using. There's no one model or paradigm that actually saves the world. Some short introduction to Auth. As I said, it is built on these logic or data flow variables, and the implementation that is available has lightweight threads where you can actually spawn thousands of these, and they're layered on top of actual operating system threads, so you can have very high concurrency in your code. And if you have a machine with many processors, this high concurrency could pay off. Like in example, you have multiple thread declarations. Each thread gets executed on its own and does something. What these three threads actually does is bind variables to values. This vertical bar is consing, so you create a list with the head of A and the tail, still unknown, is X1. X1 is bound in another thread to a B and something as of yet unspecified, and X2 again to C and to nil, the end of the list. So when you actually want to do anything with a list like computed length, then what happens is this calculation waits for the variable list to have a value. As of yet, it doesn't have one. So once this first thread actually executes, list is bound to something, but you don't know as of yet how long the list will be. So in this case, we actually have to wait until all three threads in whatever order ran until we know the length of the list. But what we do not know is in which order they ran, whether they ran in the order given here. So then length of list wouldn't wait for anything, because everything, every data would be available then. Or if they ran in opposite order, or actually in parallel, whatever. You just declare what your variables' values will be, and when they are calculated, the values you do not know. You just know you will wait until they are available for you for the computation. Another example is a multi-threaded implementation of a a simple mapping function, taking one list to another list by applying a function f to every element. So this is more or less the traditional way to code it in a functional language. And then you just put in a thread here for every element. So computing the function f on each element is done in an old thread. So if computing this function is expensive and you have lots of threads available, you can do it in parallel without explicitly having any spawning code or whatever, other than this notious thread statement. The second example is actually taken directly from a great book by Van Roy and Haridi, which is definitely worth reading if you're interested in awesome how to program with it. Another example language from which you can take ideas and learn something is Haskell. As I said, it's a non-strict or lazy language, which means like you have a function f from floats to floats. What it does is ignore its argument. This underline is just a variable that is not used, so you don't need to give it a name. And what it does is to return a 5. So if you call it with an argument, that would produce an error, like dividing by zero, I wanted to say. Who spots the error? What it actually does is it does not evaluate this argument because it is not needed. You don't need this underline in this expression, but it just computes the expression and then returns it as a result. So if you have any arguments, they are not evaluated before you call a function, but only when needed. So that's quite likely. An interesting example, or maybe an eye-opener, what you can do with laziness is when you want to compute the squares of the first n numbers, you can actually compute a list of all numbers, all integers, an infinite list, apply a function to each element of that list. For this map function, which takes one list and produces a new one. This is the backslash is short for this symbol for lambda. So this is a function taking an x and result in returning the square of x. You apply that function to every member of the list, an infinite list, it takes infinite times. And then you just take the first n of those elements, you get the first n squares. And because you don't evaluate what you don't need, you can do this computation in finite time. This vastly simplifies algorithms.
If I may interrupt, I apologize, but the viewers around the world are complaining because they cannot see the slide.
Oh,
you know,
sorry.
We got mail, you know, we want to see the slide, so.
Sorry.
No, it's okay, thank you.
Fantastic.
Slides are more important, you can hear me. Okay, one problem with such a lazy setting is you only compute what is needed. You have referential transparency. You can compute something one time or 10 times. Or the machine will do that for you, you don't know. So how do I do input-output? Because I just wanted to, when I say print some string, I want it printed at that point in time when I reach that code with that code, and I want to print it once and not by accident 5 times. So the idea the guys of Haskell came up with is to use monads. It's a mathematical structure. It has some nice properties, and what it actually amounts to here is that every input-output action is you compute it, and what is the result is an abstract action. And you end up with a list of actions. The monad makes sure that if you first say to put a string somewhere and afterwards ask to read a line, the monad makes sure that these actions actually are executed in the right order, because with the purely functional setting, it could happen that this thing is executed before this one. The structure of the monad helps here. So we have these actions, and then they need to be executed somehow. So you have in Haskell a main function, which is of type IOA, and IO is just a symbol for this IO monad. A is a variable, type variable. You can have arbitrary type there. And what you actually do is you plug into this main another IO action. And by plugging it into main, you actually get it executed. So whatever IO action is reachable from main, in a sense, is executed in the end. And things that are not connected there might be computed for no reason. They are actions that are never executed in the end. So an example is a word count function that prompts you for input, reads a line from standard input, and returns, splits it into words, the line, and computes the length of this list of words and returns it. And this do notation is actually the syntactic sugar around the monad to have a readable program. Monads will come again on one of the next slides. Or actually already on this slide. One way you could put the strengths of Haskell to use is the model of doing concurrent computations on shared data in a way that is quite different from how you do it with a traditional pthreads, etc. mutexes. Because what you do is you just take the variables, their values, you do computations, you assign new values to the variables, and when you know you are done with your computation, you commit all this. So what actually happens is you record all the reads and the writes to these variables, and then when you say commit, it is checked that no other computation interfered with yours, wrote other values into those variables that you would have missed. And if nobody else interfered, the stuff is committed. If somebody else interfered, you're restarted if you are the second or the other interferer has to restart. This definitely is a way to program much easier than with having explicit locks and having to make sure you don't run into deadlocks when you lock multiple locks, etc. Of course, it works best when you have rather low contention, because if everybody competes for a single variable to write there, then everybody except one will have to restart most of the time. But looking for parallelism that is exploitable is always looking for areas in the code that do not contend too much. Because if you have too much contention, it doesn't pay off to parallelize. This software transactional memory idea actually is put to use in multiple languages, but Haskell is a rather nice playing field here. Oops, sorry. Because it has a few nice properties. They invented another monad called STM for software transactional memory, and all the creation and assignment and reading of variables can only be done within this monad. And so whenever you create a new variable, you give it a value and you get an action that actually has to be plugged in somewhere to be executed, to be evaluated, of type STM monad of a variable of type A. And you can read it and you stay in this monad, and you can give it a new value and stay in the monad. And actually to execute all this stuff, to commit, you build up a large computation using these first three and using the values there and functions, pure functions on these values. And actually committing the old stuff is done the atomically function that takes such a computation and actually executes it. With one indirection, it goes into the input-output monad. So if you plug that into main, then the old stuff is executed. So the nice property of this is that you can't actually, you can't incidentally read a variable outside of a computer of a transaction, or write to a variable outside of a transaction. The type system ensures that every operation on these transactional variables is actually done in a way that within the transaction that you ultimately commit. So this makes it much easier to implement this securely in a language like Haskell than say in a language like Java or C Sharp. And the ideas here are not only important for multi-threading scenarios, but also you can take ideas from these languages for the good old imperative stuff that you need, like resource management with, or memory management together with resource management in C. Malloc and free, you actually can't write large functions with getting that right, or large code that doesn't forget to free something that has been malloc or does not free something that has already been freed. C++ with the RAI idiom of releasing something in the destructor helps with the memory management, but often is not used in the code. So we have lots of crash reports for OpenOffice that ultimately are due to memory errors. And when you want to free in the destructor something that can fail and could thus throw an exception, like having a wraparound fclose function that can actually fail, then it won't work in C++ because you can't throw from a destructor, so you need to a more complicated setup where you release the resource before getting to the destructor, and you have to, if in the code, if you have already closed, then do nothing and blah blah. The Java thing with try finally is a little better for memory management. You are relieved there by the memory, the garbage collector, but for other resources, it is still cumbersome to, if you want to have two files open at the same time, you have to write big blocks of try-finally stuff. And then, yeah, you could just as well have higher order functions in your code. You already saw some of them in action on previous slides, and have this whole stuff much simpler. As an example, again, Haskell, you want to have a function that has a file open, a handle open, and closes it. At the end, no matter if an exception is thrown or not, you have this finally function in Haskell, and it is not a keyword. That's interesting. It is a function. You can, if you want, slightly different semantics, like make sure that what happens when this one throws another exception, which exception to throw. If you want to make hard decisions there, you can write your own code then. Easily. So you have this first building block, a function that takes a handle, and another function that actually does anything, and the resulting function makes sure that the handle is closed on the end. So you write a second function that takes two handles and copies from the one to the other. And this is just some syntax then, which nicely nests, and down here is what you're doing: read the content from one handle, put the one large string, compute it incrementally as you need it, put it somewhere else, and return nothing because you have nothing interesting to return, and then combine this to just make use of this function. But as you see, you can, if you have this idiom of doing something with an open file, you can wrap it up in a function that takes another function as its argument, what actually is done. And this again is, these are the functions that you pass in with this lambda notation. So readable code and quite cool. A short outlook on how OpenOffice via UNO is affected by these problems of having to be more threat aware, and whether we can actually use UNO to make to improve. UNO just is, by the definition of it, a bunch of threads that work on abstract objects implemented in whatever language. And by design, each object can be accessed from multiple points, unless you just create it for yourself and make sure you don't give it somewhere else. But most objects are passed around in the code, so they can be accessed from multiple places. And each object itself has to make sure that it is thread safe. So again, it's hard to avoid deadlock in those situations, because you have to lock when you change your invariants. You have to release the locks before you call the methods of some other object, because those methods will also lock their mutexes. And also a problem is if you have an API, if you have multiple methods that you have to call one after the other. It is often the case that you want to call them atomically, but you have no atomicity mechanisms in UNO. Each function call, each method call will lock again, and in between the lock is released, so something can go wrong there. When you create your own object and only use it yourself, and no, it won't be used by anybody else, still the object will lock, which causes high costs. And it is similar to the problems the Java API had, that in many places they designed classes that had exactly the same problems, and they started to invent new classes that work around these problems by not locking their methods. So, you know, does it fit into a world of multiple threads? Not really, I would say. For one, we do have work going on to have a threading framework, as it is called. Kai Ramme will have a talk on it today, I think today in the afternoon, this afternoon. It does help to get the code straight, to avoid problems like deadlock and things like that. But I guess it will result in having these objects clustered into their context, into their threading domains, instead of exploiting or making it easy to exploit parallelism that could be there. So it is an experiment where I'm curious where it will lead us. Another problem, of course, with UNO is that it is the least common denominator of all the languages that are used to implement those objects. Actually, we have C++ and Java and Python as the main languages at the moment. And in the UNO model of computation, you can only easily introduce concepts that are known to all these languages, or else it would be hard to integrate these languages. So it is not easy to experiment with the ideas that come from other languages, like this lightweight thread support, where you have tons of threads at the source level that are mapped to the available hardware or operating system threads. Or this software transactional memory stuff, it is not easy to integrate it into UNO, to have actual transactions that span multiple objects. You can, of course, use this within an object implementation, within a single module, the method that is called from the outside, but you cannot easily span multiple methods, multiple objects, and for example, have transactional memory ideas applied to it. What you know does probably help or could help is to integrate new languages at a bare bones level into the system, so that we actually could start using other languages to implement parts. Maybe someone steps up and writes a Haskell bridge. So the conclusion, we do make sure, like with the threading framework, that we actually run correctly on a limited number of execution units. But what we will have to take care of in the future is to make sure that we run efficiently on a large number of threads on execution units by exploiting the parallelism that is in the code, and not by hiding it behind a global solar mutex and having infected a single thread of applications. So this is a great endeavor, really, I guess we'll have to take in this future. And when we're done with it, we'll probably have a snappy application that will also be fun to work with in 5 years from now. I don't know. But always remember, don't get too overexcited. That's it.